Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
This is me. All the way till 3. I'll be me after 3, too. We're in the 18th story downtown Chicago in our beautiful Skyline Studios. Hi, it's John Williams. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, you can hear us Saturdays from 10 to noon, and you can also hear us at the Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we post Thursday evenings around 5, judged best in the state by the Illinois Broadcasters Association. The Rascals will be talking about a lot this week, including the hearings, which are just now underway. I don't know if you've had a chance to be listening online, watching on TV, if you've had a chance to think much about the proceedings as they're going on right now. I've got a few thoughts about them. I've watched about every minute of it, and I think actually it's all going as you might imagine, actually as you might even hope. The Democrats are very scripted. There's not a lot of volume there. The Republicans are pushing back. You just heard a soundbite from Jen in the news, and it's the very same one I pulled as well. Jim Jordan, he without a sport coat, leaning into the microphone and firing off what he had prepared as well. And that was a denunciation of the credibility of one of the witnesses, Ambassador Taylor. He said, "You're their star witness." So far, I think the thing is fair, and I don't have any problem with it.
It reminds me of those surveys you take where you are asked the same question like 8 different ways.
Yeah.
It's just so much of the same stuff repeated over and over and over again.
And I guess it's really, in fact, Ambassador Taylor's opening statement was exactly what he had previously or essentially said before. I've been able to read what he had said before. But then the questions come. And it's interesting, too, because both sides, Nunes and Schiff, after making their initial statements and questions, defer then to attorneys. So then they have counsels. They have these guys who you and I don't know, attorneys that are sitting there, and they're good at this, and they drill down, asking one leading question after another to get the intended results. And I thought both of them were pretty good at that, too. I didn't have any problems with the way that went. I mean, I have my own opinions about this sort of thing, but I think the Democrats did a good job making their case, and I thought that the Republicans were on point, questioning. In fact, just real quick, Elif, play for us one more time here. You heard this in the news, but this is Jim Jordan, and this is him questioning Taylor. And this is, if you wanted to summarize the sort of disagreement that the Republicans have with the proceedings, it goes like this.
Let me read it one more time. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yarmak on September 1st, 2019 in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. We got 6 people having 4 conversations in one sentence, which I mean, even though you had 3 opportunities with President Zelensky for him to tell you, you know what? We're going to do these investigations to get the aid. Didn't tell you 3 different times. Never makes an announcement. Never tweets about it. Never does a CNN interview. Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had 3 meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And 2 of those they had never heard about as far as I know.
And President
there was no reason for it.
President Zelensky never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
Mr.
You're
Jordan.
The guy. You're the guy based on this. Based on, I mean, I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told, now again, this is, I hereby swear and affirm from Gordon Sondland.
When he finally got a chance to respond, because they gaveled Jordan's time finished, he finished his statement, and then they let the ambassador, the former ambassador, Bill Taylor, was the top diplomat in the Ukraine, serving at the request of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Ambassador Taylor's testimony wasn't all that new, as I said. But when he finally got a chance to respond, he said, well, first of all, I never said I was anybody's star witness. Jordan said, well, they said that. They both sort of chuckled. He said, I didn't say I was a star witness. And then he sort of refuted or expanded on some of the points that Jordan made. But that was the back and forth of it. And that was maybe the most volatile or you know, prime time, ready for prime time TV moment that you had in the whole hearings. I also learned that it's Kyiv, not Kiev. Steve, going forward, if you hear me just drop occasionally into conversation, well, have you ever been to Kyiv on a Steve Bertrand travel? Know that I'm talking about Kiev. I've been to neither Kyiv nor Kiev before, but now I need to say Kyiv. Schiff said, too, Adam Schiff said that he does not know the whistleblower's identity. There was a moment before the thing got rolling, and they said, well, wait a minute, are you going to call forward the whistleblower? You are the only person in the entire United States Congress who knows the whistleblower's identity. You know it. Why can't we know it? Is that person going to testify? Schiff said, I do not know the whistleblower's identity.
When that started, when that was the beginning of the hearing, I thought, oh, this is going to be a long day.
And it didn't devolve after that.
It did not.
There was also a point where they got into an argument about how facts would be presented as evidence. Assume facts, will it be the same sort of rules that you have, the federal rules of evidence? And they said, no, this is not necessary. And they were kind of arguing about, will you be able to question or insert certain asterisks in the testimony of various individuals, and so it was a little clunky to start, but then it just got rolling. George Kent also spoke today, and is still speaking, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, senior State Department official in charge of Ukraine policy. So it's Kent and Taylor on the stand today, and they're all going at it. I think this, you know, the other thing that it just seems to me is not that difficult to get your head around is that this is, if you will, the grand jury part of the process. Certainly the behind-closed-doors meetings are that as well. You don't see Donald Trump there, and they don't get to control the witnesses, but in phase two, they will. And so I think the Republicans are scoring their points as necessary anyway.
Well, that's true, but it's also that the grand jury happens to be made up of people from both parties. So, you know, you have to be careful for it not to become, I mean, it is a democratically led move, but you know, if you refer to it as the democratic impeachment, that's not in the spirit of it, unfortunately.
It's also not a slam dunk for either side, is my scorekeeping. This text message says, John, Jim Jordan is a poor excuse for a human being. 815 says, other than the fact that all of this stuff's been corroborated by others, Jim Jordan has zero credibility based on other issues he's involved in. Kent looks like a popular actor. This would be not Bill Taylor, but George Kent, who is the senior State Department official in charge of Ukraine. Kent looks like a popular actor from the 40s or 50s. I can't come up with the name. Any help? Both of them, Kent has on a gray suit, a gray vest, a blue shirt with a yellow, blue, gray bow tie and matching pocket square. And then salt and pepper colored hair. Bill Taylor is kind of cut from the same cloth, not a bow tie, but both of them look the part of men who've just given their lives to studying Ukraine.
The glasses, though, the weird on wiring on the side.
Yeah.
Did you notice? I couldn't stop staring at it.
I did. Taylor has these wire rim glasses, thin wires, you know, spectacles, and then, but they bow way out on the side, don't
they? Yeah, they remind me of like cables holding something on a ceiling.
But, you know, so I'm wondering what these guys are going to look and sound like. And they look, you know, here's another thing that I think both of them are doing, and I think it speaks to their credibility. They're not doubling down. Where yes will do, they say yes. And when the other side makes a point, they concede it. They don't do a yeah, but. They're just answering the questions to the best of their ability. They do not appear to be partisan in any way. I think that's the great thing about the testimony today. Taylor and Kent are just telling you what they know. And as you just heard Jim Jordan saying, well, did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do this? And Ambassador Taylor's answers were no left and right. It would have helped his case if the answer had been yes, like, yeah, I was in on the call. But in each instance, he just said no, flat out no. And if you will, in each case, Jordan scores a point. If Ambassador Taylor was partisan about this, I think he would have said, yeah, but now wait a minute. No, but now wait a minute. Yeah, but however. And he didn't do any of that. They're letting the chips fall where they may. So I think that's why I sound fairly neutral about this or pleased about this. You know, I expected Devin Nunes to say that the media and members of the intelligence community are horrible and that the Democrats are bad. I wasn't shocked by that. Schiff had his own points. I don't think he had as much vitriol. But I think this thing is playing out with as much civility as you or I could hope for so far. So there's my take on where we are today. 312-981-7200 if you agree or disagree. I'd like to get your take on all of that. By the way, as it is now officially winter, you know, anytime it gets to single digits and there's snow on the ground, it's winter, regardless of what the calendar says. I've been looking at this book called The Body, A Guide for Occupants by my all-time favorite author, Bill Bryson. We're going to get more colds and flus now because we're all staying indoors. We're not outside. We're all sharing each other's breath and germs, and now it's flu and cold season, earlier than you wanted. And he pointed out in this book about the human body and how we work that the thing that you can do to best keep yourself from getting the flu or the cold is, anyone?
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands. Wash your hands for a really long time. And antimicrobial soaps and wipes, he said, yeah, they just kill some of the bad germs, but they also kill some of the good ones. He's not a big fan. He pointed out that they did this experiment, and it's been replicated at other universities, where they put a sort of liquid dye on somebody's nose, and then they put him in a social setting like a cocktail party. And then after a couple of hours, if everybody at the party mingling about, getting drinks, you know, maybe touching each other a little bit, socializing as you would at a party, they turn on the fluorescent light. And in that liquid that was originally on this guy's nose was a dye. So now you see everywhere that the dye went. And they found out that it was all over the room and everybody was infected.
You know, that's nice. You could do a scientific study for that. But you know the way I learned that?
No.
Stand on an L platform and watch someone sneeze and during winter and look at their exhaust fume go.
Yeah.
Right? And how far it travels. Those are wet molecules traveling up your nose,
even if
50 feet away.
How about it? Even if I didn't interact with this guy at the party, he touched the punch bowl. I came over and got some punch. He touched the doorknob. I used the same doorknob. And really, the research says, for instance, that if you and I kissed, there would be less a chance of the transfer of the germs than if you touch your hand to your eye or nose, and then you touch the table, and then I come along and touch the table. And now I'm pushing it all over my face because we touch our face 16 times a minute.
I just did that as you said that.
Whoa.
So we are all smudging ourselves left and right. And this has been replicated a number of times. They turn on the light and people go, whoa, I wasn't even over there. Well, somebody was and you were there, so now it's on you. So I don't know what you're going to do about that, except wash your hands, wash your face, wash your hands, wash your face.
Or wear gloves all the time.
He said that, in fact, in surgery, you know, if a doctor is seeing you as a patient, your doctor should wash his or her hands for 60 seconds. 60 seconds. He said they never do. And it's one of the reasons that 2 million people a year get infected from stuff they pick up at the hospital. And almost 100,000 people a year die from something they didn't get until they went to the hospital.
You know, it's funny you're talking about it this way today, because yesterday you were talking about how Bill Bryson said how difficult it is for us to die.
Yeah, right. We are pretty good about not dying from cancer. 1 in 6 people who smoke will get cancer. 5 in 6 people who smoke won't. So our body's always fighting and doing us good. But, you know, you go to enough cocktail parties, you smoke enough cigarettes, the chances are better that you will get cancer or you will get the flu at this party than not. Yeah, it does sound like it's sort of contradictory, doesn't it, Steve?
Well, no, both can be true, but it's just an interesting tack on it.
Yeah. He said the problem with antibacterial soaps is that they kill the good bacteria on your skin as well as the bad. Oh, and you won't want to hear this, but I'm going to tell you now. You have about 100,000 microbes, these little germy things, per square centimeter on your skin. 100,000 of them per square centimeter on your skin. The greatest difficulty, Atul Gawande, who's a famous doctor and author, is getting clinicians like me to do the one thing that consistently halts the spread of infections, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. And by the way, it is the time and the temperature. If you have warm, soapy water, it literally lifts that stuff off. It's not that you're going to kill them with hot water. It's the warm water is just a better way to remove the things. So there's all I got for you as we move forward into winter. 125 WGN. Steve Bertrand has WGN Radio News. And then, yeah, we are talking to the dean of the Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism.
Last night, I didn't sleep. I was so stressed.
There's a lot of tossing and turning these days.
I had a dream that I was on a call to Ukraine.
All this political talk can make a person drowsy, irritable, and a little crazy.
When I woke up, I saw that I had called a crane company. I now own a $400,000 crane.
And that's a sign of politosis.
Politosis? Can you get me something for that? And do you have any big construction projects coming up?
The answer is no to big projects.
Darn.
But the answer is yes to politosis, and the cure is Eurelium Life 9000.
Was Eurelium one of the Russians?
No, Eurelium Life 9000 is the all-new, all-natural wonder drug made by an ethnically blended group of scientists in New Jersey.
Will it help me sleep?
Duh. It tackles lack of sleep, sore throats, itchy eyes, runny nose, scurvy, whooping cough, Dutch elm disease, and a host of gastrointestinal disorders, including but not limited to ringworm, nausea, constipation, too much gas, not enough gas. Hey, have you seen the price of gas lately? And that thing where your intestines aren't lined up right?
Did you say Dutch elm disease?
Take Eurelium Life 9000. 9000 is a pill, liquid, chewable briquette, capsule, gel cap, eye drop, nasal mist, ear burst, time release arm patch, powder, ointment, cream, and now an exciting new home epidural kit that has had some success.
So when I get stressed out about all this political talk, I should just take Eurelium Life 9000, right?
Don't take Eurelium Life 9000 if you're pregnant, operating heavy machinery, or plan on getting pregnant while operating heavy machinery.
Well, I do have this crane.
I prefer the chewable briquettes, but I'll tell you what, that air burst is kind of trippy if you just want to try that sometime. It's 1:35 now. This is WGN. I'm John Williams. So there was a story in the Northwestern student paper the other day, and it was about Jeff Sessions' visit to the campus. A Republican group had invited him to speak. You know how these things go at universities. And the reporting by Daisy Conant, the reporter in the Daily by the Northwestern students, included sentences like, former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has championed students' rights to free speech on college campuses throughout the country. On Tuesday, this story was dated November 6th, by the way, so this is last week, he spoke against the students protesting a talk that he gave at Lutkin Hall on Tuesday, criticizing what he called their stupidity and adding that Northwestern should not tolerate such behavior. As he was speaking, there was a ruckus. Some of the students got mad. Some of them dropped F-bombs. And then Sessions kind of pushed back at them a little bit. Sounds like it didn't get completely out of hand, but the story fairly tells the story of what I think happened there at that event. I wasn't there, but this reporting in the Northwestern student newspaper, I think, gives me a pretty good assessment of it all. Evidently, after writing about that, the staff at the student paper started to hear it from students online, maybe on Twitter, maybe direct text messages to them, maybe their friends on campus. And so then they wrote an apology, which they posted on behalf of the editorial staff of the student newspaper. They wrote, on November 5th, Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke on campus. The Daily sent a reporter to cover that talk. We recognize that we contributed to the harm that students experienced, and we want to apologize for and address the mistakes we made that night, along with how we plan to move forward. And then they apologized for a photo or photo coverage of the event. Some of the protesters found, they write, photos posted to reporters' Twitter accounts, re-traumatizing and invasive. Those photos have since been taken down. Later, they wrote, some students voiced concern about the methods the Daily staffers used to reach out to them. They point out that they use the student staff directory, and they write, we recognize being contacted like this is an invasion of privacy. They wrote, we also wanted to explain our choice to remove the name of one of the protesters. Any information the Daily provides about the protests can be used against the participating students. While some universities grant amnesty to student protesters, Northwestern does not, and we did not want to play a role in any disciplinary action that could be taken by the university. I think that's a fascinating point, right? So if we put your name and picture in the paper and then you get in trouble for how you behaved at the event, maybe you get kicked out of school, who knows? We don't want that to happen to you, so we're going to take that information down. Ultimately, they wrote, the Daily failed to consider our impact in our reporting surrounding Jeff Sessions. They wrote that they met as a staff Sunday to discuss where our reporting and our empathy fell short. And then it really hit the fan. Maggie Haberman from the New York Times said this is crazy. Robert Feeder, the Chicago area media writer, called their editorial apology embarrassing, a teachable moment, bizarre, groveling, and astonishing. It was written about in the Washington Post. Associated Press carried the story nationwide. We reached out to the editorial staff at the Daily. They declined our invitation. Charles Whitaker is on a phone line. He's the dean of the Medill School. Hi, Charles. It's John Williams. Thanks for joining us on WGN Radio.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
To be clear, this is not a product of the faculty or staff. It's not. Explain to me the relationship between the school and the student newspaper.
The student newspaper is an independent 501c3, has been almost since it was incorporated. The students operate autonomously. They do not have a faculty advisor. They make their own editorial decisions independently. They will occasionally reach out to faculty for advice or consultation when they're wrestling with difficult issues or difficult studies, difficult situations. That's not a requirement, and to the best of my knowledge, they didn't do so at this moment either.
It is the paper of record, though, for the students. It's the main paper on campus, right?
It is actually the main paper for all intents and purposes for the city of Evanston. It is indeed the paper of record.
What was your reaction when you first read the story, or maybe more importantly, the apology?
When I read the stories, I thought it was actually business as usual. I didn't think anything was untoward or in any way out of bounds about the stories. I heard chatter about the Sessions' appearance, as well as the kerfuffle outside and surrounding the appearance. So actually, nothing. I didn't find anything about the coverage remarkable. My first thought when I read the apology was, my goodness, they're apologizing for doing journalism, and I wished that they had reached out to us before they made the decision to run the apology. I had had conversations with a student or two on the staff following the appearance of the stories and the photographs. It's important to note the story itself is not what students on campus and student activists were outraged about. And that's an important note. Is there was outrage in the activist community on campus about the student staffers publishing photographs of the protesters and reaching out to protesters using the student directory and other means, social media as well. There was this agitation on campus about photographs being used and how those photographs might be used against the student protesters if action was to be taken against them. So I did talk to some students shortly after that, who were feeling guilt about possibly contributing to students getting in trouble for being seen in these pictures. I told them they have nothing to be guilty about. That's what journalism is. These students have chosen to participate in this very public act of protesting against a speaker on campus. How right. Could they expect anything other than to be than for the paper record to make note of that?
You know, that's an interesting point. I'm going to pause here. Come back with me in a minute. But I think who needs an education here as well is the student body at Northwestern, not just the students. If you think you're going to go to a speech by Jeff Sessions and you're going to protest, what expectation do you have for privacy, Mr. Dean, in a minute? The dean we're talking to is Charles Whitaker from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. The student newspaper there made headlines across the country when they apologized for their coverage, which was upsetting to some of their readers, the students. I'm all for being sensitive to your audience, but it seems like they were too sensitive, Dean. And that was the point I was making a moment ago. I don't think the students that go to protests have any expectation of privacy. And I think that the student journalists who are so empathetic, I don't know how we did this, but we raised a generation of kids on college campuses now that are more feeling than we are. If they're going to do what they do, they need to know that sometimes feelings are going to get hurt and you pay the price for it. Your thoughts about that?
I don't know. I think, well, at first, yes, absolutely right. The students who participated in the protest should have no, in a public protest, in a very public space, should have absolutely no expectation of privacy. This is an act in which they wanted attention. They were hoping to get action and the attention of the administration and of Mr. Sessions. And if that was their intent, then they certainly should have expected that they would also get the attention of the media and that that would also be recorded both for posterity, but also not only for posterity, but for the not only for the current audience, but also for posterity, which I have said. I will say, not necessarily in defense of the student journalists, but this is a generation of students who have grown up watching episodes of civil disobedience, especially episodes of civil disobedience that involved people of color be mischaracterized in the media, and they are very sensitive to those mischaracterizations. This is also a group of kids who are grown up with critical race theory and gender studies and a lot of different scholarly interpretations of the ways in which media has victimized various marginalized groups, and they are hypersensitive to that as a result of those studies, and I think projected all of that and took their very basic reporting and internalized all that they are feeling and then wound up kind of forgetting that what they really did was not what other people and other media outlets have been accused of. They did very basic journalism, and for that, they needn't have issued an apology.
They're student journalists, right? So isn't this the student part? I mean, they're learning how to write a lead, and they're also learning how to react to criticism and when not to apologize or how to report.
So are you suggesting
that's right. They're navigating this, you know, in this cauldron? I think because it's Northwestern, because it's Medill, because we have so many of our alumni are prominent members of the media.
Yeah.
There's a spotlight on them, and so this was a mistake that was shouted out loud, and they were sort of pilloried for it nationwide.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, they're students, and they made a student mistake.
And
yes,
are you two agreeing that we should give these kids a break for that? More so than we might.
I do agree.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm a little confused, though, about the insertion of the race, gender, LGBTQ sensitivity signals that you were throwing out. How did that come into play here?
Many of these protesters were students of color. And I do think there was a component, and many of our student reporters are not. And so I think there is this tension between students of color who are protesting, people who are not necessarily students of color, white students who are covering them, a sense that you are coming in as interlopers, invading this space, and depicting us in ways that are not true, or a suspicion and expectation that you are going to depict us in ways that are not true. I don't think that was at all the case, but
right.
I think all of that gets conflated in the way this event played out.
So is that what maybe the subtext here is, or that's the elephant in the room? It's not the reporting on Jeff Sessions. It was white students reporting about black protesters in a way that made them feel marginalized.
they weren't all black. There were students, a multi-ethnic group of, multi-racial group of protesters. But yes, I do think it is, there is certainly a race and ethnicity component, a subtext to this as well.
Yeah. Troy Claussen, who's the editor-in-chief at The Daily, said, I just followed his Twitter thread, one of the first things I was told when I came into this position was that I was the third black executive editor of The Daily in more than 135 years of publication. I knew that would come with a lot of pressure, but I didn't realize how much until over the past 2 weeks. Being in this role and balancing our coverage and the role of this paper on campus with my racial identity and knowing how our paper has historically failed students of color, particularly black students, has been incredibly challenging to navigate. I'll let you go here and after you respond to this, but what would you say to Troy? We asked him to come on, and I don't blame him for not doing it, but I mean, what would you say to Troy?
I think he has to navigate, as you know, all journalists of color do, where your not that you divorce yourself from your race and ethnicity, but what you do is you use that lens to be as fair and objective as possible, to provide a perspective that the newsroom may not otherwise have, but you stay true to the core values of journalism. And that is, again, accuracy, objectivity, trying to be as balanced as possible when you cover stories. That doesn't mean, again, that you abandon or try to divorce yourself from what you bring to the table. It means that enhances the coverage. But you've got to be very careful not to allow that then to prevent you from doing the job at hand. And again, I feel for the students. It was a very difficult moment for them. They were getting lots of pressure and kind of hateful messages on social media. And I think they bowed to that pressure in this instance. But I think this has been a learning experience for them.
Charles Whitaker is the dean of the Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism and a man gifted with an extraordinary voice. Charles, thank you.
Thank you, John.
I want a little of whatever it is that you're having, Charles.
Please.
Nice to meet you on the phone. Join us in studio sometime. I know you've got places to be. Go do that, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Take care.
Charles Whitaker at Medill. I think it would be pretty hard on campus these days, just because I have raised a couple of people through their or into their 20s. One's 30, one's still in his 20s. And I work with people that are in their 20s, and I think they are more sensitive than people in their 50s and 60s. And I think they're less tolerant of, I don't know the end of this sentence, stuff.
Well, my point was, right, you make they're students and students make mistakes. It is alarming that they felt the need to apologize for looking up someone's phone number. I mean,
right.
You'd think that that would have come up in a class as standard operating procedure.
I know, I think this generation so does not want to offend that when somebody said you offended me, they shrink away instead of saying, well, all right, let's look at the evidence here. You know what? I know you don't like that, but I didn't offend you. I didn't do anything wrong. And if you're unhappy about it, deal with it, Chucky. Even if the person's name's not Chucky, you just say that. But I don't think these kids have that kind of a backbone these days, he said, painting with a broad brush.
It's the overwhelming role of PC behavior that has just taken over.
I know. And if you want to say, okay, boomer, you go right ahead to me anytime during this conversation. But this does sound like our millennials versus boomers conversation last week, doesn't it? And I think that this is a little bit a part of that. It's about a lot of other things, say race, say journalism, but I also think it's generational. I don't think we did this at the Saluki newspaper at SIU Carbondale when we were down there a long time ago. And by the way, I'll say this about students who work on student newspapers. That is a long, hard job. Some of them get paid, some of them don't, but it is a dedication that hardly any other discipline requires, right? If you're an accountant, if you're a math major, if you're whatever, if you're a journalism major, you not only got to go to your classes and do the things students do, but then working on a student newspaper is work. And it's exposing yourself, and it It lets everybody see your sins, doesn't it? And those are tough lessons to learn. So I have maybe more empathy for them than I'm sounding.
And you're learning them when you're ignorantly confident,
yes,
too.
Yes, I know. Right? You're just, it's not the best. Your clay is still a little wet here. And so you're going to make mistakes. And I mean, as a broadcaster, every time we said or did something that was really stupid on the air, for that matter, even as I speak to you today, you just feel so vulnerable. And then when somebody texts back and they say, you guys are idiots, it still hurts. You know, I can just imagine how these kids were not ready to process what was coming at them.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
Yep, that's me. At 206, we're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago, 18 stories above the city. And we really appreciate you tuning in, calling in, and texting in, too. Same phone number either way, 312-981-7200. I've been reading, in fact, I think I just read in the last 36 hours, Neil Pasricha's book, Reach's book, You Are Awesome. I don't read books like this that often. In fact, it's rare that I do. But I looked at a little of his TED Talk, and I read a little of the book. And I thought, I think this is so helpful and so smart that maybe I should get past my own feelings about these kind of help books and actually give him a chance to talk with you. His book is You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. His TED Talk has been viewed 3 million times. He's sold millions of books, and this latest of his, you may have seen his Happiness Equation or his other 5 books, will debut at number 1 on the, what is it, International New York Times bestseller list. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you, John, so much for having me.
It's a terrible introduction saying I don't normally do this sort of thing.
Why not?
Well, because welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here. Would be better. How do you describe this kind of writing, book, or talking that you do?
Well, what I do is it's all about intentional living. I sort of feel like we all have 30,000 days on this planet, and it's incumbent upon all of us to live them as best we can. So right now, the thing I've been thinking about, John, is you look around, we live in the most abundant time ever in human civilization. You can press a button, a car picks you up. By the time you get home, you got food waiting on your porch. Your phone's entertaining you the whole way. We're living longer than we've ever lived. We've got higher education rates. At the same time, we've got higher than ever anxiety, loneliness, depression, mental illness. So that sort of crux is what I was trying to explore in You Are Awesome, which is all about building resilience, which is something I'm trying to build in myself and in my kids.
Are you saying that were we more resilient, we wouldn't have some of those 21st century feelings?
Well, exactly. And part of the problem is it's so good. Right? No one's getting shipped off to war at the moment. We aren't going through a major famine. There's no plague that I heard of. At the same time, we've got cell phones that we're holding 2 inches from our face at all times, showing us how much better everyone else's life is. No matter how good your lunch is today, somebody's at a lobster buffet in the Maldives right now. So anxiety rates are spiking. I think the root issue is the fact that because we have it pretty good, we no longer have the skill set to handle failure or even perceived failure. That's why if you get 2 likes on your pictures, you think, I got no friends anymore.
That's ironic then, isn't it? It's so good, we feel bad.
Exactly.
That could be a title of a book. It's so good, we feel bad.
Because we have everything, we can no longer handle anything.
Do you know, you pointed out the cell phone. I sometimes bring up with my colleagues and friends the 3 best inventions of all time. And it's a moving target for a lot of us. For a long time, my 3 greatest inventions of all time were the plaid thermos, because how does it know, the seedless watermelon, and then I usually drop in either commercial aircraft, which, think about that, within 4 hours right now, you and I could be in a sunny, warm place. Our whole world experience would change in a matter of hours. For the cost of 75 cups of coffee, you could change your environment. That's a fantastic thing we don't fully appreciate. But I think usually I substitute something relative to our smartphones.
Oh.
Voice-to-text technology or just the phone itself. I mean, Human beings are different as a result of that gadget.
Well, I want to take that phone and I want to send it plummeting down your list, John. I think there's three P's of problems with cell phones. The first one's productivity. McKinsey now says we spend 31% of our time bookmarking, prioritizing, and switching between tasks. We're not actually doing anything. We're just deciding what to do. And if you ever stared at like a Netflix screen trying to decide what movie to watch with your partner or whatever, but then you take so long trying to decide that you don't actually watch anything before it's bedtime, you know what that feels like. Second P problem is the psychological one. We are comparing everyone else's greatest hits with our director's cut. So I mentioned about someone's lunch I was looking better on Instagram. And the third one is physical. Did you know when you expose your eyes, your brain, to a bright screen within an hour of bedtime, you don't produce melatonin, the sleep hormone, so you don't get as restful a sleep. So the next morning you've got low resilience again. Three P's, a problems, smartphones. Gene Twenge at San Diego University says that the spiking anxiety rates are due to the ascendance of the smartphone.
I grade my phone screen so that it doesn't display colors. Have you tried that?
Yes.
Too? Yeah. And then I got a new phone and I forgot how to do that. But were I smart, I would gray my display. His is a black and white gray display, ladies and gentlemen.
Just holding up my phone to say it. Yeah. And it's always in airplane mode, too. Because the device is a push device. It sends you stuff all the time, texts, alerts, notifications. That's a push device. Turn it into a pull device, move it into airplane mode, so you get to decide when you check in on it.
So I suppose if your book was 200 pages of Get Rid of Your Smartphone, it wouldn't be a bestseller. So then how do you combat all of this?
Well, one of the solutions I propose in Chapter 8 of Your Awesome is this idea of scheduling one untouchable day per week. So I have found myself just totally at the mercy of my phone and the internet and constant interruptions. So now, John, one day a week, I schedule myself untouchable. What does that mean? That means no one knows where I am. I've got no contact with the outside world. I've got no internet access. Even my wife doesn't know. And guess what? It's when I get most of my writing done, most of my creative ideas. People listening might be saying, oh, yeah, it's easy for you to say, you know, but I'm an emergency room nurse. I can't do that. Well, can you go on an untouchable lunch? There's no reason why you got to pack yourselves into five people in a Camry and drive over to the subway together. You can just leave your cell phone at your desk for an hour. Even taking an untouchable lunch is enough to give you a little bit of a mental release.
How many people have their cell phones on the table at restaurants?
Exactly.
Well, we don't even give ourselves a break on a date.
I gave a speech last night to a few hundred people. I said, put your hand up if you sleep within 10 feet of your cell phone. Pretty much every hand in the room went up. And I said, look, if you had a bottle of wine before bed every night, you woke up and you drank a bottle of wine, and you slept with a bottle of wine beside your bed, what would we call you? An alcoholic. But the fact that we're all addicted to our phones doesn't seem to be alarming people, but it should. Untouchable days are one of the little solutions. The other one, though, is when you wake up in the morning, don't reach for that phone, plug it in the basement. Start your day with something I call the 2-minute morning mind strengthening practice. Just on a cue card or a piece of paper, write down every morning, I will let go of, I am grateful for, and I will focus on.
Do those again.
The first one is, I will let go of. It's a proxy for the Catholic confession chamber, or a very, very, very cheap form of therapy, where if you write down and crystallize something you're anxious about or worried about.
Stop beating myself up for that stupid thing I said or did or failed.
The nasty email I sent at 11 p.m. last night, the 5 pounds I gained over Thanksgiving holidays, the fact that I'm wondering how my book's going to do compared to another author. I will let go
of. What's number two?
I am grateful for. Our brains want to focus on negativity. We have something in the middle of our brains called the amygdala. It flashes flight or fight hormones at us all day. That's why we all rubberneck on the highway to see the traffic accident. We don't want to look, but we kind of do. We crave negative news. We have to practice our brains focusing on the positive. Write down a few things you're grateful for every morning. They need to be specific. Don't just say family. Write down when my husband Antonio put the toilet seat down. Like, it has to be specific. And the third one is, I will focus on. Everyone has an endless could-do and should-do list. Just writing down one thing you actually will do takes away decision fatigue, which is bringing us all down. Then at the end of the night, you just cross that one thing off, and your day doesn't feel like a flop.
Sort of like the admiral who said, make your bed.
Yeah, exactly. The purpose of making your bed, of course, is just feel like you made your bed, that you got something done. Rig the game so you can win it, and then your mind will be strong all day.
That's why I had you come on, because I think a lot of us go, yeah, there's anxiety, and yeah, we all ought to be better versions of ourselves. Yours is specific. You give very relatable, very doable things that, as you describe them, make me go, he's right. This would help. We don't do this. There's two things that stood out in your book to me that you haven't mentioned yet. We'll get to that. Neil passed Richa. Is it Richa or Rika?
Richa.
Richa.
It's like passing a salt shaker, reaching for it, and relaxing afterwards. Pass Richa.
Pass Richa. His book is You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. He is it tonight that you're going to be at the...
Yeah, Anderson's Bookshop.
In LaGrange.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? That's a nicely... You're going to love that town.
Come say hi.
I lived within walking distance of the Anderson's Bookshop in LaGrange, 26 South LaGrange Road. For years, he's going to be there at 7 o'clock tonight.
I'm glad you said the time, because I had no memory of what time it was.
Heads up, 7 o'clock. You went to Harvard.
Yes.
Good for you. You didn't feel very comfortable there, did you?
No. I mean, you get there, and I guess you feel special when you get in, but then you get there, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, everyone here is super smart. You kind of feel like the dumbest kid in class. That's how I felt anyway. I felt like a tiny fish in a really big pond. I was super stressed, and I was lucky enough in my first couple weeks of Harvard to get lunch with the dean because I had won this financial aid package, basically.
And you sent him a 5-page thank you note.
Because I was so shocked that I had got this financial aid. It was in his name, the John MacArthur Fellowship. So I wrote the guy, John MacArthur, a letter saying thank you. That's all my life story and a big thank you.
And what happened?
He invited me to lunch.
Why?
Why did he invite me to lunch?
Because his secretary said to you, no one's ever sent him a 5-page thank you note.
That's true.
And I thought, that's kind of sad. I'm sure he got nice little emails and
so
notes.
So this scholarship was covering $70,000 of tuition for me. I thought the least I could do is write like a nice, thoughtful note.
Hell yeah. 5 pages, you bet.
But when I got to the lunch, he's like, so how's school going? I'm like, super stressful. Everyone's hanging out with these millionaire consultants and bankers with black bags under their eyes trying to be one, too. I find it super stressful. And he said, you know what you are? You're like a guy standing outside the beach. You're looking in, there's some sunbathing beauties, make them whatever gender you want, but you're with 1,000 other people outside the beach, and when the beach opens, 1,000 of you are going to run in to chase these 10 beautiful people. Problem is, 990 of you aren't going to make it, and even if you're one of the 10 that does land one, get one of these jobs, guess what? You'll be looking over your shoulder your whole life. I said, okay, so John, the dean, what should I do? He's like, go to the library. Find the nerd studying in the stacks. Find the companies that are broken or bankrupt or have a bad reputation. They aren't flying recruiters here on private jets. They're different, and different is better than better.
So you wrote a letter to 100 different companies.
Yeah, you know, at the time it was like the places like the Blockbuster Videos, the Kmarts, the people that were going through challenging situations. He said, his point was valid. He said, John, he said to me, if you get into one of these companies, they will give you more work than you can handle. They will give you a seat at the table. You will be a big fish in a small pond. And you know what? The research shows that when you put yourself in those situations, what they call your academic self-concept goes up, and it stays up for more than 10 years after you leave.
Wait a minute. So if I'm in a room, if I'm at Kmart, not Google.
Yes.
If I'm at Kmart, not Google. Google's really prestigious. But if I'm at Kmart and I've got a degree from Harvard, or I'm making decisions, maybe I'm going to feel more powerful because I'm a big fish in this small pond.
Exactly. Not just feel more powerful, but guess what? They're going to give you more work. They're going to take your opinion more seriously. If you go to Google, your degree or whatever validation you have is immediately neutralized by everyone else at the table.
Okay, so listen to this. Is this where the 5 and 9 comes in?
Yes.
You said there's this thought experiment. Would you rather be a 5 in a group of 9s, a 9 in a group of 9s, or a 9 in a group of 5s?
According to the results of all the research on big fish, small pond studies, you'd rather be a 9 in a group of 5 to increase your self-confidence. Look, the book You Are Awesome is all about resilience. So I'm trying to talk to myself about how to improve yourself when you're feeling down. And you know what you should do? Sign up for the marathon in the slowest category. Don't run the Boston Marathon. Sign up for the one that, you know, is lesser known. Tee off from the tees closest to the hole. Rig the game so you can win it.
How is this not inspiring people to underachieve, though?
Well, here's the problem, John. We live in a community these days of 8 billion people. They're all on Instagram. They're all prettier than you, more attractive than you, have a better six-pack than you. They have more followers than you. Actually, I think the problem is we all feel like teeny tiny minnows in a gigantic ocean these days. So I don't feel bad about giving this advice, and I take it myself because I want to get out of this global community that we're living in on the internet and get us back to scenarios where we can actually win and feel proud of ourselves. That's what's missing. That's what's partly causing so much anxiety.
So your correct answer is go be a nine in a group of fives, but then don't rest on your laurels. Mm-hmm. Now achieve. Now work hard.
Exactly. And guess what? You will feel better about yourself when your confidence goes up. You will do better, and then you will rise through wherever you are putting
it. That was one of the two inspiring things. I thought they were all inspiring, but two of the things I said before the commercial break you hadn't yet said that I thought were also powerful. Another one was the word
yet. So we all talk to ourselves. You know what? You get a bad health check back from your doctor. You say, I don't work out. I don't take care of myself. You don't get your pitch approved. You think, I'm not creative. You don't get a promotion. You think, I'm not a leader. You're talking to your three-year-old. They say, I don't like broccoli. Do you know what these statements all are? They have periods at the end of the sentence. We keep our minds closed to future possibility. I said this book was about resilience. The way I define resilience is it is the ability to see the sliver of light right between the door and the frame after you hear the latch click. So with all those sentences I just said, add a dot, dot, dot and the word yet. I don't take care of myself yet. I don't go to the gym yet. I'm not creative yet. I don't eat broccoli yet. And yes, I taught my three-year-old to say that. So now I don't let him say I don't like broccoli. I say, I don't like broccoli yet, Dad. You know what? When you leave your mind open to the possibility that you might change, everything changes. The word yet, Y-E-T, is actually a powerful mental switch.
I think that's amazing. I think that is so true. I think it empowers people or enables people to think, I haven't done it yet, but maybe I could. I know people for whom that's applicable. You're talking to one of them right now. The book is called You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. Maybe you've seen this guy on a TED Talk on YouTube, Neil Pasricha. His last book was The Happiness Equation. Right now he's going to be at the Anderson's Bookshop in LaGrange. On South LaGrange Road at 7 o'clock tonight. We're out of time. Please come through our studio again, and well done.
Thank you, John, for having me. I really appreciate it.
By the way, Steve, you know, we just talked to Neil Pasricha, and his book is You Are Awesome. And I was just thinking, if in hearing that you thought, oh, everything's been easy for you, Neil. You went to Harvard. You give TED Talks. You're a best-selling author. But he talks in his book about some of his failures in life, too. And one of them was his first marriage, which I think is kind of funny because he's the guy with the happiness equation. He's Mr. Yes, We Can. And his first marriage was short-lived and not successful. And it didn't end in great acrimony. But it sounds like he and his wife got married too young before they knew each other that well. And he then's going to Harvard, and she goes out to Boston to live with him, but she can't find a job. She's not happy. She decides to go back home. So they're kind of apart for a while shortly after they get married. And then when they're reunited and living together again, they went on a climb. They went to some mountains, and she was into climbing up the rocks. You know, they weren't doing Mount Everest, but they were doing some arduous climb up this mountain. And she was loving every minute of it, and he was hating every minute of it. And when they got to the top, instead of high-fiving, it was a little quiet. And when they were laying in bed that night in the motel in the town where they had climbed the mountain, they were sitting there silently. And then one of them says to the other, are we right for each other? They just kind of knew the day that they climbed that mountain. And a short time later, they just owned up to the fact that they weren't right for each other and they went their separate ways. And now he's married, and I think he's got three kids, and is doing pretty well for himself. He's in LaGrange tonight at 7 o'clock. Did you watch Jeopardy? Probably not. I don't watch it regularly. I'm usually in the office doing something. But there was two reasons to bring up Jeopardy today, and we'll get to both of them. First, they're doing the Tournament of Champions, and Emma Betcher, the University of Chicago resource librarian or internet librarian, she's got some sort of digital component to her job at the UC, the one who brought down the reigning champion, who was from Naperville, right? So that was kind of an interesting story for us. Well, she's on the Tournament of Champions. One of the categories, are we ready with this, Elif? Was words that use all five vowels.
Words that use all five vowels. Emma, off you go.
All five vowels, 800. It sounds like you're writing a novel, but it means to empower or formally sanction an act. Emma.
What's the answer?
It sounds like you're writing a novel, but it means to empower or formally sanction an act. Emma.
What is authorize?
That's the word that uses all five vowels.
Words that use all five vowels, 1,000.
So she goes on to the next one. Okay, Elif, don't hit the answers quickly this time. Let's see if we can play at home. This is all five vowels, question number two.
Ecstatic happiness.
I got it.
What is it?
Euphoria.
Hit it, Elif.
Ecstatic happiness. Kyle.
What is euphoria?
Right.
Ding, ding, ding. Attaboy, Steve.
How about that?
You get no money. All right, here's the next question. Question number three.
And now abideth faith, hope, and this third virtue. Emma.
This is not all five vowels. This is the Bible. Okay, so play the question. I guess I should have told you that, right? All right, play the question again. Question
and
number three.
And now abideth faith, hope, and this third virtue.
Anyone?
Emma.
Bueller? Anybody know the answer to that one? Faith, hope, and love? Faith, hope, and I'm going to say love. Hit it.
And now abideth faith, hope, and this third virtue. Emma.
What is charity?
Correct.
Charity. I knew that. Charity. Not a regular Bible reader. All right, here's the question and answer for Emma. Question number four.
Words that use all five vowels, 600.
Dancing Queen can feel the beat from this instrument.
Oh, come on.
Emma.
What is tambourine?
That's
tambourine.
It.
That was easy. All right, Jeopardy. You knew that one, right, Lauren Lapko? You would have guessed tambourine from...
Yeah, I'm just not as quick as you guys.
Well, it helps that I've actually watched the episode. I think what's tragic is that I actually go, because I actually recorded these. All right, this is question number five.
Words that use all five vowels, 4.
To inject someone with a small amount of a disease so that they can become immune to it.
Got it.
Go ahead.
Inoculate?
Hit the answer, please. Droove.
What is to inoculate?
Yes.
What is to inoculate? That was Droove. D-R-U-V. That was number six, right, Elif? Was that number six or number five? That was number five. All right, let's do question number six then.
Swiss mathematician's principle says the pressure in a fluid moving horizontally decreases as its velocity increases. Emma.
This is one of those ones you go, I don't even know what you just said. I don't even know what, and by the way, this isn't, words that use all five vowels. This was mathematicians. I read books about mathematicians. I do. I don't even know what the question was.
Yeah, are we asking what that is or
who or what?
Invented, well, not invented, but discovered this?
Can we get the answer to number six, please, Ms. Garris? Play answer number six, please.
Emma.
Who's Bernoulli?
You're correct.
Whatever. That's the difference between us and them. The people that not only knew the question, but then knew the answer. Because I didn't even know what he was asking for. They get to Final Jeopardy. Here's the Final Jeopardy question.
In the title of a groundbreaking 1890 expose of poverty in New York City slums, these three words follow: how the. 30 seconds. Good luck.
All right, hit stop. Play the question again.
In the title of a groundbreaking 1890 expose of poverty in New York City slums, these three words follow: how the. 30 seconds. Good luck.
So it's a book about poverty, a turn of the century, how the, and I said good die young. I thought, oh, that's where they probably got the song, How the Good Die Young. It's an expose about poverty. That was my guess. So I'm writing that down. And then they go to the answer part. Remember that guy, Droove?
Droove, you're smiling. I like that. Let's take a look at your response. Did you come up with the right one? No? What is We Love You Out? That's very kind. Thank you. Katya, 1995. You're left with $5. Okay. Let's go to Kyle Jones now.
Oh, that's so sweet.
The guy wrote We Love You, Alex, because he didn't know the answer. And when they taped this, remember, this didn't happen yesterday. They taped these shows in advance, off camera, off the show, as they were taping it. Trebek told them about his pancreatic cancer. Now, this guy's not going to win. Emma Betcher's knocking it out of the park. If he'd bet all of his money, he wasn't going to win anyway. And he didn't know the answer. So he looked at his family in the crowd. This young man did, Dhruv did. And he smiled at his mom and dad. And they knew that he couldn't win, but they said later, we knew he was going to do something special. And then he said, we heart you, Alex. Play it one more time, because it's a little lost on the radio. If you see the TV, you see Trebek, who's unflappable anyway, right? But he struggles to, just like the professional host that he is, move the show forward.
Prove you're smiling. I like that. Let's take a look at your response. Did you come up with the right one? No? What is, we love you out. That's very kind. Thank you. Costs you $19.95. You're left with $5. Okay. Let's go to Kyle Jones now.
You can hear the unwavering in his voice.
I know. Then Emma got it right, right?
He wrote something down, then paused. He started off with what his other half lives. Yeah, you're right. What was your wager? 4,401.
That's
that
the one guy.
Takes you into a $1 lead over Emma. She had
that's the second guy.
200 led for most of the game and wrote down the correct response. Did she wager more than a dollar?
Yeah.
Yes. All right, Emma, way to go.
So the University of Chicago librarian advances. But just what a dramatic story. And just, I don't know, doesn't it do your heart good to know there are people in the world that would go out of their way? He said, as I was trying to think of the answer, he said, maybe I could have noodled it out, that Dhruv guy. He said, but I just couldn't stop thinking about poor Alex Trebek. And I just think, you know, they should say, all right, Emma, when I get to be king, Emma, you've won. You advance to the next round. Dhruv, you're advancing to the next round too. And then they'd say, yeah, but he finished in last place with negative $93. I don't care. He's going forward on the virtue of his character. Shouldn't that mean something to you people? I got to take a break. But there is another very interesting thing that happened on Jeopardy this week. Did you hear this one? After this, John facetiously uses all five vowels in order. Facetiously uses all five vowels in order. 708 said, how does charity use all five vowels? Did I misunderstand the question? Yeah, I didn't play the category for you. That wasn't all five vowels. That was Bible stuff or something else.
So, can you imagine if that really was the category title? Bible stuff.
Sounds like the set. I think one of the funniest things Saturday Night Live has ever done is when they do the Celebrity Jeopardy.
Oh, so great.
708 said, he did know the answer, but he did that anyway. Wow, I didn't read that. So Dhruv knew the answer, but rather than write down the answer, wanted to send that message to Alex Trebek. All the more reason to advance him to the next round, says me. Back to the other Jeopardy question in just a second. The Midwestern University Multi-Specialty Clinic in Downers Grove offers a comprehensive patient-centered healthcare experience at their dental institute, family medicine clinic. They have a speech-language institute, physical therapy institute, and an eye institute. At these clinics, you get exceptional care from a team of highly qualified faculty and students. Learn more at mwuclinics.com or call 630-743-4500, 630-743-4500. The Midwestern University Clinic is your family's home for health care. Anything else I wanted to mention? Just about our last guest we had on a little while ago, Neil Pasricha, whose book is You Are Awesome. 309 said, John, how in the world does this guy stay that positive? I don't know how he does. He must have down days, but he works at it, and that's what the book is. It's for developing resilience and living an actionable, happy life. And 708 said, John, that guest was awesome. Thanks for having him on. I should probably do people. You know, when I introduced him, I said, I don't normally do guests like this. And he goes, why? And I didn't have a good answer. It's because I think a lot of times these people are full of crap. I don't think they have that much to offer. And I think his book really does. 7 o'clock tonight, LaGrange. This was on Jeopardy this week as well, the Tournament of Champions. Listen to this question. Listen to this answer.
This sneaky alliterative baseball action has been done using a telescope, 1951, and an Apple Watch in 2017. Stephen.
Oh, what is stealing signs?
Yes.
How about that? Is that, I did not know that. That is, it was acknowledged that the Houston Astros were stealing signs in 2017. I mean, it's not rumored. It wasn't contentious. When they put it on Jeopardy, you talk about fact-checking. They're standing by that. Kevin, I didn't know that. Did you?
Well, there was a report. I don't know if it's necessarily been acknowledged officially by anybody, but, I mean, the Athletic put out a report a couple days ago on multiple players. We're on record that the Astros had a camera in center field, and it relayed video of the catcher's sign to the pitcher to a monitor in the dugout of the Houston Astros, and then they would signal from the dugout to the batter by all sorts of different means of communication. There was reports that they would bang on a trash can a few times to signal a changeup, or a whistle, or a clap, or some sort of noise to give a cue to a Houston Astros batter of what was coming.
Sports Illustrated posted three videos, and two of them, while a player is up against the Astros, you don't hear any sound, and it's fastballs. But in between, it's an off-speed pitch, a changeup, and you hear, under the din of the crowd, bam, bam.
Yeah,
like somebody took a garbage can lid. Do they have garbage cans, metal garbage cans in the dugout? You hear this bam, bam, and the batter now hears that and goes, okay, off-speed pitch, and he cranks on it.
Yeah.
He jacks it. Okay, that's pretty compelling to me. Just for my amusement here, I'll play that. I want to hear how Alex Trebek put the question. Did he leave any room for error on that?
This sneaky alliterative baseball action has been done using a telescope, 1951, and an Apple Watch in 2017.
Yeah, so he said it happened. That they were
Well, the Apple Watch was involving the Boston Red Sox.
Oh, so that wasn't the Astros story they were talking about there.
No.
I thought maybe they related for the Apple Watch back to the dugout or something, but
yeah, the Red Sox one had something to do with video or sign stealing being relayed to an Apple Watch, and then that was signaled to batters. There's an investigation from Major League Baseball. The Astros say they're cooperating. That's really all they
what
said.
What a coincidence, then. So on the same week that comes out, Jeopardy just happens to have a question that calls out the Astros practice the very thing, remembering that show was recorded previously. They didn't just go, hey, it was in the news, quick, throw that question in. The categories are chosen randomly, and it was taped in advance.
But how far in advance do they tape these episodes?
According to the Sports Illustrated story, anyone who follows baseball knows the Astros have been doing something like this for a long time. It just says filmed months in advance. Months,
gotcha.
In advance.
Wow, that's timely. Yeah, I mean, sign stealing has been done forever in baseball. But it's how are you stealing the signs?
Okay, so this is my question. 312-981-7200. Call or text right now. I'm just curious where your head is on this. 312-981-7200. I asked Mark Carmen off the air. I'm going to ask you on the air. I'd like you to respond too. 312-981-7200. Do you think it's wrong for a runner on second base to see the signal the catcher is giving and then him to say, hey, fastball, or signal somehow back to the hitter? A player on the field catches the signal and he somehow gets that information to the hitter to anticipate the pitch. Are you okay with that? I'm 100% okay with that.
Yeah, I think I'm okay with that. I mean, Major League Baseball has ruled that you can't use electronic technology.
Okay,
so then in the Astros case, they did use electronic with a camera in center field.
Or for that matter, Boston, right? If you've got a camera and now your cell phone or Apple Watch indicating back to the dugout, that's kind of high tech, isn't it?
That's
funny, though, because we say it's okay to steal signals in one case. It's not okay to steal signals in another case?
I think it's just a matter of the technology component of it all. I mean, it's in some ways similar to identifying a tip that a pitcher's giving and saying, hey, when he drops his right elbow right before he throws, it's going to be a curveball. It's kind of the same thing. I mean, there's a human element, the human component to it all.
You know, baseball allows for so many sins, if you will, like the phantom tag, and there's some trick plays that once in a while might try and dupe a player. If, to me, you're just cagier or smarter or are able to sell something to the umpire, that's part of the game. I think if you pick up a signal and you're a base runner, I think if you pick up a signal and you're sitting on the bench, it's okay for you to signal that pitch. I don't like a camera in center field. That's a little extraordinary to me. Tony wanted to jump in here. Hey, Tony, what do you say? You're on WGN.
Yeah, I'm with you, too. I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
I'm
so glad you called. What about, but I don't think, and Kevin surely doesn't, that you should be able to put a camera in center field, focus on the catcher, and then call into the dugout and say, here comes a curveball. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's pushing it. Have you ever watched an Illini football game?
Yeah.
Where people stand behind coaches that are giving signals to the players with big pieces of cardboard or wood, and they hold those up. I couldn't figure out what that was. That's so the people in the press box, the opponents, can't see the signals being called.
No, well,
never,
I guess they...
It looks so childish. It looks like third-grade drawings.
Well, but they would still... Say I'm on the other side of the field, and I see your sign that says the next play to call. I would still have to know what that play was, right? Because I don't know what hieroglyphics you've concocted for your team.
Right, but I guess if you watch enough games over and
you
over...
figure it out. Yeah. Thanks
all
for the phone call. Yep, you bet. Appreciate you joining us. Are they allowed, Kevin, I think you know the answer to this. Do they have speakers in the helmets of football players and they tell them, you know, on a shortwave radio what to call?
Only two players, a quarterback and then one player on defense.
Oh, they can do that. And they do. And so the quarterbacks, Trubisky's got something in his ear like that?
Yeah, that's why a lot of times you see quarterbacks cover up the ear holes on their helmets. If it's too loud in the stadium, it's difficult to hear. But yeah, there are little speakers built into the helmets of quarterbacks.
And does the signal that they give Trubisky ever go something like, throw it to the guy that's open? Do they ever say that?
Try to throw it to your teammates, just not hit, the opponents.
See their uniform. Look at your chest. See the color of that jersey? Find another guy with the same color uniform and throw it to him, dummy. Do they ever say that to him?
I can't confirm that, John, but I'm sure there's been some choice words from Matt Nagy on the sideline.
773, John, it's not wrong to steal signs. 630, I think they could figure out the date of the World Series months in advance and schedule that. The Tournament of Champions, some of you are telling me the turnaround is quicker, but I don't think that they put that category or question in there anticipating this new revelation here. I think it was a coincidence, a happy one. I'm amused by the whole conversation. Okay, Ella says shut up. It's 2:55 on WGN. Tomorrow, a representative from the Secretary of State's office joins us. We tried this last week, and candidly, it went really badly. This time, we will have answers to your real ID question. The difference between my show and Ro Khan's with Anna and the gang is that they get Christian Bale. I get Dave Drucker from the Secretary of State's office. Still, I like what we're going to do tomorrow. You had so many questions about that real ID, and I just don't think we answered them very well. So we said, text them in. We gave them to them. They have answers. It's everything you need to know about Real ID tomorrow at 1:30. Hey, thanks for listening to my podcast. This is John Williams. I'm live weekdays from 1 to 3. And remember, our Mincing Rascals podcast drops Thursdays at 5. The Rascals is a round table of talkers and journalists. This year, judged best in the state by the Illinois Broadcasters Association.